Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another author event here at the Poison Pen. My name is Patrick. I'm the science fiction and fantasy selector. And today we have one of my favorite fantasy novelists, Jen Lyons, who has written a phenomenal series called The Ruin of Kings, or at least that's the series. She is here now for her fourth book in the series, The House of Always. Jen, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to spend a little bit of an evening with us here at the bookstore.
Well, it is certainly my pleasure. So fourth book series is actually A Chorus of Dragons. Ruin of Kings is the first one in the series. That's totally cool. And five books and we're on book four. So it's starting to wrap up, which is just wild. It feels like just like last week, I was actually physically out at the Poison Pen. And that was not true. it's been well over a year.
Has it been 2 years?
Not quite. Just because we have not actually been releasing the books on a year schedule. So, but it definitely has been, I want to say we were out there in, I was out there in October of 2019.
Yeah, that's right. You were with Kelcade doing a tour of all around the United States before everything just so rudely got shut down.
Right. It turns out that was the last time that that we would be doing that sort of flying all around and seeing everything.
Exactly. Hopefully not forever. We hope that, it's a mixture of digital and in-person events here at the bookstore, because we like seeing everybody in person. I know our audience really does as well. I bet it's sort of a blessing in disguise for you, because at the schedule that you are releasing these 500 to 600 page tomes of fantasy, epic fantasy, great epic fantasy.
Tombs is a good description too, though.
I don't know how you could do it. I don't know how you could do a book tour physically and write these books on the type of schedule that your publisher has you set onto.
Well, I mean, normally it maybe wouldn't have been quite so big a deal. Certainly, I'm not going to lie that the pandemic definitely slowed down my writing process. So, right now I actually just finished what I like to call the draft zero of book five, which is then I go back in and kind of revise it out immediately before I let my editor see it. But normally this would be done already. The schedule was that it would have been finished a couple of months ago. But last year was just really very difficult in terms of, writing and making yourself sit down and write. So
I have found as a reader, it was really hard to sit down, at least for the first few months, and really focus on reading and getting into books. I had a hard time focusing. It's way different when you're writing, obviously, but a similar part of your brain. And this pandemic has just taken out a lot of the writing process from a lot of writers. You're not alone. I've talked to many who've said, this has been the hardest year for my writing, despite the fact that I had more time on my hands to actually sit down and actually write.
Right. Theoretically, it should have been way easier for everybody, but no, just the opposite. And I actually, I'm not the only person I know of. I know a lot of people have said they've had a difficult time with reading as well. It definitely wasn't just the writing side of it. It was all of it. It was a very, very stressful year. We have to acknowledge that a lot happened.
A lot did happen.
It was the longest decade I've ever experienced in a year. Yeah, so
we made a lot of references to Groundhog Day, didn't we, Jen?
we did, and it deserved to be made. I laugh now. I can go back and laugh because keeping in mind that this was completely a coincidence, but there I was, you know, in my house, basically not leaving, kind of confined there, except for, you know, trying to figure out how to get groceries and things like that, mm-hmm. writing about 12 people who are confined to this lighthouse and can't leave. So I think it lent a certain verisimilitude to it, you know.
It did, it really did. And that's part of the cool, that's a great factor of this book, is the fact that this entire book takes place in one location. And yet you do have your characters all around the lighthouse. It isn't that they're just like in one room or all adventuring together. They are separated out. They are all in danger. This book just starts with a bang and just keeps on going.
Well, there's a little bit of like haunted houseness to it that's mm-hmm. going on, except of course that instead of being trapped in a house with a ghost, they're trapped in a house with an evil god. So, you know, stakes are slightly different. Who is, if he gets released, is going to destroy everything, and we'll start with them. So, right. You know, yeah, that was fun.
So what is it like confining your characters to one particular space when you're writing a novel like that? Because as much as that they are in one space, I mean, they do feel very separated in a lot of, and quite a bit of it.
Right. You know, it was really funny because very early on, I realized that it was going to be like, I definitely regressed back to my, not back to my D&D game days. I haven't stopped playing, but there was like there was part of it that felt much more like I need to map this out. I need to have a working map so I can keep track of exactly where everyone is at any one time, because there was so much choreography that was really important to know who was where, you know, who could respond when things went wrong, who could, you know, if somebody screamed for help, who was conveniently accessible and who couldn't possibly get there in time. So most of the time with the other books of the series, I haven't had to like get quite that granular with everyone's location. And this time it was like, no, got to know exactly where everyone is.
It feels a little bit like writer's chess when you're the way that you're describing it, but it's actually like that in the book too, where, you know, you have to figure out as a reader, okay, where is everybody? And one of the things that I really appreciate that your publisher did was give us the beautiful floor plans.
Yes, well, those are my maps. That was what I used to figure out where everyone was. So,
these were your actual drawings, your rendering.
Yeah. Those are my maps. I mean, that's actually been true the whole series, is that I've drawn all of the maps and all of the interior artwork. So usually though, it's a much more sort of distant kind of, you know, like, okay, this country's over here and this, you know, this city's over here. And this time it was like, no, here's this room and this is how big this room is. And here's this, you know, this hallway and things like that.
I like the sort of locked room mystery aspect that you have to this as well. So you can kind of harken back, even though it's epic fantasy, you always have those touch points of like Agatha Christie, something like that, where, you know, you go back and you're trying to figure out what's going on as the reader along with the characters. And so I like the fact that it's got this really strong mystery element, mystery vibe to it as well. But like I said, like, with the action and the adventure like cranked up to the nth degree. I mean, Hercule Poirot would not have an adventure like this.
Well, they, you know, it was really funny when I first started sitting down to write this thing. I knew where I was going with it, but it hadn't quite clued in how much of, like you said, like a locked room mystery this was, where I was going to be, you know, a little bit of that and a little bit of, like I said, the haunted house kind of thing, right, going for it as well. And that I think really fits in with the theme of this book, because, you know, this book is not to put too much of a pun on it, very much about being in people's heads. Right. So there's a lot more psychological, you know, really dwelling on thought processes and everyone's individual traumas and, you know, the psychological turmoil that they are in after everything I put them through with the previous three books.
And you have put them through some hell. I do have to say that. Has it been a lot of fun too? Because, you know, when we get to book, usually by the time you're done with book two, world building is mostly set aside, right? You can really get into the meat of the story. You can really ratchet up the action as you have in this. Has it been fun to really be able to do less of that world building and more of the characters and the action and the adventure that you probably needed to, especially in book one, a little bit in book two?
Well, you know, so actually I laugh about this, right? So book one took place in one part of the empire, book two took place in a completely different part of the empire that had a radically different culture and society. So multiple different, radically different cultures and societies. So I had to completely start over. Like it wasn't, you know, I couldn't just say, well, it's the normal Kuros, you know, everything else. I kind of tried. I was going to have Jorat not be quite so different. And it was the first time I've ever had a culture rebel where the entire society just went, nah, we're not going to be like that. so I had to do that world building twice, right? And then book three, like you said, for the most part, all the world building was done and I could just, you know, steamroller through everything kind of falling apart, you know, mm-hmm. which was the fun bit of that. And then, of course, for book four, I immediately decided to have a bunch of stuff happen that was off in territory nobody had been to before. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of, you know, people have asked over, you know, through the books, like, are we going to see more of the other races in the world? You know, we get to see, they're all, technically speaking, they're all humans, but, you know, you get to see the Kuros groups and then you get to see the Vane groups. Everyone's like, so what about the, you know, what about the Voromir and what about the Vordreth and some of these other ones? And I was like, well, as it happens, you're going to see a lot more of what the Voromir became. Some of the Voromir became different groups, but it's not important. So it's a lot of water stuff. It's a lot of water stuff. And more pirates than I expected when I originally sat down to write it. And of course, I think it's no surprise considering there's one on the cover, Kraken.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, who doesn't love Kraken?
That's exactly it. And, you know, I love the nods that you bring into, you know, kind of the traditional fantasy elements. Like we've got our Kraken, we've got our mad gods, we've got trope is the wrong word, but frequently used. But you really like to turn these subject matters on its head. It's not as simple as just a Kraken or as a mad god. You know, one of the things I truly loved about the Ruin of Kings was you took us to essentially an ancient, almost Sumerian-like society, and that had never been done in fantasy before, or hadn't been done in a really long time, or wasn't commonly used. I mean, I could be completely wrong. I love the fact that you're willing to kind of stretch us as readers.
Well, I mean, I think personally, I like to say everything's been done. Everything's been done. And there's definitely been books that have focused on that, on, you know, more of Sumerian, Assyrian, Babylonian cultures in the past. It's just that in my particular case, you know, having grown up in a household that had very strong Assyrian influence, that snuck in. You know, it would be difficult for me not to kind of, you know, throw that in there. So there was a little bit of that in there, and there was a little bit of, you know, I think as a lot of fantasy books are Well, whether they realize it or not, a lot of fantasy books are influenced by Rome, particularly if you've got any sort of big empire running around. It's difficult for us not to go to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
But at least not in anything that's kind of Western centered. That had a strong impact and influence. But I do like, you know, because I love fantasy, you know, you pretty much don't write this sort of thing unless you really love fantasy, but that doesn't mean I don't like twisting things a little bit. So, you know, the Kraken aren't quite the daughters of Laka aren't quite the same as you know, what other people might be doing. That's fine, you know, it's my particular thing on it. So, you know, you have a Kraken and a dragon that are in a romance together, because sure.
Why not? Yeah, why absolutely not? I love that though. I really love your ability to get creative, and you do the twist, but you make the twist work really organically, which, like you said, a Kraken and a dragon in a romance does not sound like a possibility. How can a writer pull this off? And yet you have managed to pull this off in The House of Always and in your entire series. And I love that. I love the fact that you managed to get those to work. So I've got to ask, as a writer, how did you get these things to work? What were your thought processes to make something like this actually happen in the book and make the reader believe it?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, amongst other things, I tend to take the scenario, take the situation that I've got, and see where that leads me, rather than trying to force it the other way. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, you have two creatures that are both sentient. You know, the Kraken in my world are not unthinking monsters. They're perfectly capable of you know, every kind of emotion and intelligent thought. So why not? You know, why would they have to you know, yes, it's unorthodox, you know, it's a little cross species romance, and that's a little weird. But you know, once that's there, then that can, you treat it like any sort of other relationship where that's important to them. The relationship becomes part of their goals and motivations. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, it becomes one of the drivers for some of the things that happen here, because you have somebody who's, you know, you got somebody who's basically just trying to help out their lover. And then you treat it straight. You don't try to, like, you know, you don't try to, I actually don't twist things that much. You know, you decide on what is going to be in the, you know, what's going to be in the book, where those things are going to go. And then you let, you know, I let those things go where they naturally kind of would. I need to backtrack on that one a little bit, which is because I do think that authors, we do control everything in a book. So, you know, we control the universe. Ultimately, anything that we put in there is in there because we wanted it to be there. And it's perfectly possible for me to have looked at this situation and gone, well, I don't want that to happen, and change it. So, you know, I'm not going to make it sound like this was a thing that I didn't control. I did. I thought, right, hey, this would be cool. And I put it in. But like, there's things that happen at the end of the first book that happened not because I necessarily planned them originally, but because I saw the pieces that were in play and the scenarios that were coming together. And I said, huh, it would be really interesting if this was the result of that.
Exactly. And I think that that's really cool. I think that your processes of where you've led your characters and and the creatures of your world, you've led it into very interesting territories. We oftentimes now, you know, we've been exposed in epic fantasy to Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, and Lord of the Rings. It's probably the three most popular fantasy epic films. And so it's hard not to lean into one of those three kind of genres. And if I were to tell somebody who you'd be most like, I would say, well, you'd probably have more of a George R. R. Martin leaning, but you've got kind of the character sensibility of J.K. Rowling, and you've got the, you know, you've got the fun world building that we see in Tolkien. I really enjoy epic fantasy, and I'm always just amazed at the amount of world building and how much I enjoy diving deep into the world. And it's apparent that you really do too.
Guilty.
Where have your characters taken you? And are you sort of surprised at where they've gone now in book four?
There's definitely, I always, having said that I am totally in control of all of it, it is definitely true that I've had characters who've rebelled, we'll just say, and tried to go their own way. I think Anne Leckie has a saying about this, that whenever a character diverts and goes their own way in a story, then there's really nothing to be done but to track them back to the point of diversion and kill it with fire. Mm-hmm. That is completely valid. Whenever that happens to me, I usually take a step back and say, is that what I really want to do? Or is this my subconscious trying to tell me that there's something more fun over in this direction and I should take a look at it? Mm-hmm. So I don't always do that. Sometimes when a character decides to have a rebellion, I take a harder look at it and say, okay, is this actually something that I should allow? Taienso kind of became as important a character as she became in book one because I allowed it, you know, because she staged her rebellion. I went, okay, we'll make you a more important character. I've made no secret of the fact that I've pretty much tried to kill off Talon in every book she's been in, and I haven't succeeded yet. She keeps coming up with reasons to keep her alive. Definitely in this book, there are some characters who I had originally had different plans for, and they, without spoilering anything, decided to go a different way. But I think the books are better for it.
I think when you listen to yourself, right, and you listen to your characters, I always think that those end up, I don't know, I find those to be more interesting. I find that I'm more engaged with the books, and I think that the authors who allow themselves to do that take us into really cool directions. And every time I read one of your books, I feel that way, that you've allowed the characters to sort of do what they want to do, even though I know that you're ultimately in control. And sometimes if it takes you down direction B, and direction B is like, that leads to a dead end or, you know, a bad situation that, you know, is not right for the story, you're going to divert it back.
Yeah. But sometimes that's not the case. I think Cariel at the end of book one, what she did, that was very much an instance of, you know, a character going, no, I'm going to do a slightly different thing than you'd planned. And I went with it.
So you talked really briefly about Dungeons and Dragons, and I'm part of a Dungeons and Dragons group myself. And I think one of the fun things to do is, you know, that's storytelling in group and in mass. Mm-hmm. And of course, we as the players are going to do things that, quote unquote, the dungeon master are never going to expect us to do, and take in directions that you're never going to plan to do. So do you feel like by playing those games, it sort of prepared your mind to learning how to deal with those situations?
Absolutely. There is so much, and it's always so funny, because when I was a teenager, I used to very often get the very classic, well, this is great, but how is this ever going to be something you're actually going to do anything with in your life? You know, your game is cute and all, but what are you ever going to do? And now I'm looking back and saying, there is so much that I have learned how to do from playing tabletop role-playing games that otherwise would, you know, and have a direct correlation to, you know, my career and my abilities as a writer. The ability to change direction on the fly, to very easily just adjust and accommodate a different path, that's been very useful. You know, you get feedback from an editor saying, this particular plot thing isn't really working. You know, you either need to justify it better, you need to change it. And it doesn't throw me. You know, it's just like, yeah, okay, we'll go over here then.
Do you have sort of a favorite character now that you like to have in your head?
Yeah. They're all... We have to kind of enjoy them all, right? You know, I mean, that's particularly because I do tend to have a lot of different POVs. If you want to successfully get into that headspace, you usually need to find something about that character that you can, you know, get behind. So, you know, not every character is a favorite, but there's a lot that are.
It's interesting because as I was reading through this, I realized that you have an incredibly large cast of characters. And that's fun as the reader, because now we've gotten to know them, we've gotten to understand them. Definitely this is not a book that I would recommend people jump in and read if they haven't read the other three.
Oh no. Definitely but not.
But I would say, you're an incredibly fast read, despite being, your books are incredibly, I wouldn't say incredibly complicated, but they've got a large cast, you've got a lot going on, but you maintain a level of pacing that is hard to maintain in epic fantasy. You don't bog down really very often, I don't think. I think, you know, every book has, epic fantasy has a slow chapter or two, but you really don't. What is it that you've learned to maintain that pace and to keep the reader engaged throughout all of these? Because I've got to say, it's worth the 1500 pages that you're going to read this one.
Well, I mean, I think that you just, you know, a lot of the plotting is the constant introduction of the next thing that's needed. And that is, you know, that's just a thing that I'm going to point at D&D again. You know, each individual game session has to be interesting on its own, and, you know, it'll work into a larger plot, but you know, you can't have a situation where you're going to leave your players hanging.
True.
For an entire game session and not involve people. You know, they need to have stuff to do, and you know, it's not dissimilar to, you know, plotting out the story. You want to give everybody something, you want to give your readers something to be doing. And you know, that has been a definitely an interesting challenge to do and to write. There was a pulp writer, actually, a guy named Dwight Swain, who wrote a Techniques of the Selling Writer, I think is the name of the thing, and it hasn't aged well in terms of being extremely racist and sexist, because it is. It's extremely racist and sexist. But he did a really, really good job of explaining pacing, you know, and he liked to describe it as, you know, as an inhale and exhale, right? You know, so you have rising action, and then you have the response to it. You have a problem that's presented, and then you have how the people solve it. And it's the constant insertion of the next problem. And that's kind of all it is. It sounds simple.
But it's hard to do successfully. It really is. And that's why I always say I'm a much better reader than I'm a writer. I've tried my hand and I don't think I've developed well enough to be able to do that yet. I think it takes practice. It certainly takes voice. And you can fix plot, but you can't fix voice. And
oh, yeah, you can. Yeah, you can. Absolutely.
A little bit, but I think that you have to have a natural talent with voice and with character, and you really have that.
Well, I totally appreciate you saying so. That very, very nice of you. But I mean, I think it is important not to discount the fact that I have written a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah.
And I kept writing. So you know, there are people who have gotten a very early start in their writing careers and immediately came out of the gate writing wonderful stuff, and we can all hate them and read them right, because they're great. But I freely admit that wasn't me. You know, I wrote some stuff when I was just getting started that was, you know, it was not that great. The important thing was to, I had to keep doing it.
Right. And yeah, and you've done it incredibly well. How do you keep up with 500 page books almost every 6, 7 months, 8 months? I don't, it's amazing. It really is. And you've kept the quality up.
Well, I learned, one of the things that I learned fairly early on is that it's important for me to write fast. And that's purely a defensive thing. I need to write faster than my demons. If I don't write fast, then I give myself enough time to start second guessing myself and start, you know, is this the right approach? Am I doing the right thing? Whereas if I write fast, I can get through it and then go and then analyze what I've done and start breaking it down and fixing stuff. But the result of that is that I've had to learn to get it all down as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. Which is translated into I'm a fast writer.
Yeah, that's incredible. Now, some of our audience has some really interesting things that they want to ask you too, Jen. Chanel Black says that, she says, did you enjoy writing the snarky footnotes?
Oh, I always enjoy writing the snarky footnotes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the snarky footnotes came about because, you know, when I originally wrote the book, the first book, Rune of Kings, I wrote it all sequentially, realized that that was not really working for me, and kind of came up with after the fact this idea that that Kieran and Talon would be telling each other this story while Kieran was waiting to be sacrificed to a demon. And as soon as I realized that Thurvishar would be the person putting these notes together, I realized, well, it was impossible that he wouldn't make comments. It would be, you'd have to like tie him down to keep him from making comments. So, you know, once kind of that started, it just had to keep going. And yeah, book five, I'm actually going to have two different people making comments in the footnotes.
Oh my gosh. So I've got to ask, without spoiling anything from book five, but what, you're probably in the midst of writing it right now. What is that like, feeling that you're leading up to the end of something that's been so immersive in your life for almost 3 years now?
Yeah, it is a weird feeling. I mean, I'm basically at this point, I'm revising, you know. So I've typed the, you know, I've written out the last scene. It's, you know, at this point, I'm just going back through and making sure that, you know, everything is sufficiently snarky and filling out a couple of missing bits that I've skipped. It's a weird feeling that, you know, knowing that I'm basically done.
Yeah. Not done with writing, I'm sure, because it sounds like it's too much in your veins to let that part go.
No. There's definitely going to be more books after this.
I've got another really great question here, and I apologize if I lose you. Chanel also asks, Janelle Tirith Kieran's relationship matures so much in The House of Always. Can you talk a little bit about how you made decisions about how to portray that relationship, and how important was queer representation to you when writing?
Well, you know, so there were a couple of things when I began the series that I knew I wanted to twist a little bit, and because they were pet peeves of mine. And one of them is this idea that you're going to have these two men who are going to have this extreme rivalry for a woman, and, you know, gonna just absolutely do all these things to try to one up each other. And I was always sitting back there going, yeah, but there's tension between those two. There's more tension between those two than there is between. So I realized very early on that I wanted to have this, this polyamorous love triangle going on, where in fact, all three characters were going to get romantically involved. And it is funny, maybe not funny, haha, but, when I started this out, I, you know, was just myself coming to terms with my own bisexuality, and, I was very late out of the closet on that. But I didn't really stop and think about it being important or not. It was just, it was, like I said, it was a thing I wanted to see. I wanted to see these two men getting involved with each other. And as the series has progressed, it has become more and more important to me. And I think a large part of that is because I hadn't realized how important it was to everyone else. It was how important it's been to readers. The number of readers I've had reaching out to me and saying, you know, we've never seen epic fantasy treated like this. You know, we've never seen this number of, you know, rather than just one. You know, I grew up in, I was in the high school drama group, right? You know, I was a theater kid, and you know, that's. Queer kids are not like a one-off. it's not one token person, you know, in the corner. We group up. And so, you know, this idea that there would just be, you know, like one, you know, one gay person wandering around and that would be it in a story just always seemed inauthentic to me. It wasn't really even an instance of me. I didn't necessarily like, I wasn't checking off stuff in a, you know, down a list. Oh, I got to make sure I have this and I got to make sure I have that. It was, you know, it was just what seemed right for individual characters.
Absolutely. And it, again, it reads very natural. One of the things that I always thought with it as well was that because it's almost, especially in The Ruin of Kings, I mean, you've really got this basis of the ancient Sumerians, right? So that sort of relationship, I think, was a lot more common. I mean, you heard about it in Roman history, you learned about it, you know. So I feel like, you know, until we got into like, you know, Victorian era and onward, they got a little bit more prudish about those sorts of things. And I thought that it felt right with the book. It didn't feel forced. I liked the relationship very much. I thought that it was fun to read. Where was I going to go with that? Oh, I know. It seems like there's a lot more representation as well now in fantasy as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's no longer the stodgy old white guy who's writing these novels. You're getting people from all diverse backgrounds, from African American to queer to, you know, straight to everything. And it just seems like its fantasy has really opened up into being a very inclusive and a very diverse genre. And I think that that is really cool, because it didn't start off that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, although I have to say, it's not just like, I mean, it's, there's incredible stuff happening in fantasy all over the world, mm-hmm. you know, happening in Africa, happening in Asia, happening, you know, just all over the place, and not necessarily always easily, depending on mm-hmm. the country of origin, but there's definitely some fantastic stuff out of there and coming out of different parts of the world, and fantastic stuff that isn't necessarily, doesn't have its DNA steeped in European fantasy, mm-hmm. Which I think is really important. I think it sometimes is difficult or challenging for those of us who are more used to European fantasy to kind of get behind and absorb. But I think that is a problem that is solved by exposure. You know, right. the more you expose yourself to, the more you read these stories, which are fabulous, fabulous stories, the less than they seem weird or odd or anything like that. You know, it's an easily solved problem. We just have to take those steps to make sure that these stories are being shared and told and brought in to the Western world.
Absolutely. And it seems like there's, especially in the last 10 years, it seems like fantasy has become more and more of a popular genre to read. And I think it was partly because of writers like J.K. Rowling and James Rick Riordan with The Lightning Thief, that really introduced children who are now adults to the fantasy genre. And I think that it's allowed those of us who enjoy reading it to read it. But on top of it, I think it's allowed us to open up and to be more diverse. And it's really, really exciting. And that's one of the reasons why I like your book so much, is because you take us to a place that is not necessarily discussed and not super common. I enjoy my Western European fantasy. It always will have a place in my heart, but I enjoy expanding my horizons as well. And I feel like you've done that as a writer for me as a reader.
Well, I mean, I when I sat down to do this, I told myself, it's less of what I wanted the books to be, because I very intentionally didn't try to set them in another part of, in a culture from a different part of Earth that I was perhaps not in a good place to be able to write about. You know, I don't have the background or the cultural experience to do so. But I knew what I didn't want them to be, and what I didn't want them to be is, you know, European knights and castles and things like that. So, you know, I tried as much as is possible to make it something that was in of itself, you know, that was more self-contained and more legitimately second world. I mean, that said, I'm the whitest white girl you're ever going to see. So, you know, it can't help. That's right. Going to sneak in. You know, there's no way that, I would never want to be held up as, you know, representative of any of these other, any other cultures, you know, any other sure. perspectives of this. Cause I just, you know, I'm always going to have to come at it from what I am. But I do think that the more we have stuff out there that is, that doesn't all feel the same, uh-huh. that doesn't all feel like I love him, but doesn't all feel like Tolkien, the easier it will be to enjoy the wonderful diversity of stories that are out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you're finding that in the mystery genre as well. You're finding that, you know, we're starting to travel all over the world. We're bringing in a lot more foreign writers. We're bringing in a lot, it's bringing in a lot more diversity. And I think it's an exciting time for readers in general. Chanel is a really great fan. And so she has one more question for you, Jen. And she wants to know that in book five, are we going to see more of Thirin and Cariel?
We will see a little bit more of Thirin and Cariel. I'm not gonna lie, they're not main characters and they're never gonna be main characters in this series. So, you know, they're definitely gonna be around, but I think that the main arc involving them kind of completed in book three.
Yeah.
So,
and for the audience who's wondering why aren't we discussing more in depth of the House of Always, is because the entire book is a spoiler. I have to say, Jen, I mean, because you have so much going on that if we go too far into depth, we're going to spoil the novel for you. And we don't want to do that. One of the great things about having a relationship with authors like Jen is that we're able to send her books and she signed books for us. And I've got to say, Jen, that you have one of the nicest signatures I think I have ever seen. I know that's probably backwards, but you have a beautiful signature. So if you want an autographed book, you can get them through us. And one of the nice things is that we're a Times Reporting bookstore. So one of the fun things about independents and independent bookstores is that we often report to the New York Times. So if you want Jen to continue a series past this, it's always helpful to buy from independent bookstores, just to let you know. So because our sales go up to her, but wherever you buy a book, please buy this book. So I think you've really knocked it out of the park. Little side commercial there, Jen. Mr. Mike Lyons has a question for you.
Yeah,
he wants to know, what's the per capita mango consumption in the capital of Korea?
Yeah, it's not a coincidence that his last name is Lyons, by the way. And in fact, book four might be dedicated to him. And he's being a smart ass. I'd have to look that up. I have a chart somewhere.
Mike, I think you'll make an excellent researcher for Jen. She'll be glad to send you into the office and research through there. Chanel, you can actually order. And you can always go online to thepoisonpen.com because we have more authors than just Jen who come in and do the signings for us. So, but you can just order her book through there. We ship all over the world, which is fun. I think the furthest we've ever shipped something was to Pakistan.
Oh, and that nice.
That was quite the trip there. So,
yeah.
Kind of fun. So Jen, what are you reading right now? What are you doing for when you're not writing? What also are you working on?
Well, I'm reading a Fernand Braudel nonfiction book because medieval economics is the thing, and I just started reading P. Jelly Clark's A Master of Gin, which just came out. And I mean, it's gonna be amazing because pretty much everything he writes is. And I just finished The Helm of Midnight by Marina Lostetter, which was amazing, so.
Nice, Nice. There's so many great books out there, isn't there?
You're really in a golden age right now. It is so cool.
We really are. We just read for our Sci Friday group, and we'll be discussing it, Stephen Graham Jones' The Only Good Indians. And I've got to say, that was one of the dark, it was a good book, but boy, it was dark. It was a good horror novel.
With a name like that, how could it be anything other than dark?
Exactly. So, and that's another thing that we do here at the Pen, is we have a Sci Friday group where we get a, people are joining us on Zoom all around, and we get to discuss fantasy, horror, and science fiction.
I remember when I was in there that you had this really large group, so I can imagine.
You and Kel had a great turnout for the program a couple years ago, and hopefully this isn't the last time we see you actually physically in person. I hope in you know, a year or so, that when book five comes out, we get the joy of having you in the store to celebrate book five, because that is incredible. You have finished a fantasy series.
Yep. The Discord of Gods, by the way, is the name of book five.
Cool.
So yeah, we weren't going to say anything and have a reveal, and then we realized that, you know, it's up on Audible and Amazon, and people can look it up. So
they beat you to the release of it.
Yeah.
But when will we see Discord of Gods, do you think, or do you know yet?
I theoretically I know the exact date, but I don't remember the exact date. But you know,
that's
definitely
okay.
I want to say, yeah, no, I'm not going to say anything, because I don't remember for sure. Know it did get moved back a few months because of everything that's going on, but it definitely will be in 2022.
Excellent. Yeah, everything got really weird there in terms of publishing. And then whenever you have a presidential election, everything just sort of moves around.
Yeah.
Because they'll have all their political pundit books out during a particular time period. And so all of your fiction gets moved around. And then we had the fun of the pandemic. So, you know, you could say, oh, it would be out in 2021. And really, you know, 2 weeks later, it would be 2022.
Yeah, no, it didn't get moved back much. So, you know, we're still on schedule for that.
Absolutely. And Tina, I made a mistake. We also have a Croak and Dagger book club that I run to. I'm insane. It'll be next month, next Saturday, even though it'll be the fourth. So we usually do third and third, but May was a weird month where, you know, half of it started on a Saturday, so it screwed up my schedule. Well, Jen, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure. I hope you'll talk with us again.
Yeah, absolutely. I love you guys, and thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. And again, everybody, you can get Jen's newest book, The House of Always, right here, beautifully signed by Jen. Here at the Poison Pen, we still have a few left. So if you're wanting to get yourself a signed copy, you can. And again, if you want to see book one of a new series come out, continue buying her wherever great books are sold. Jen, thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening, and thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.